This podcast is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Visit darkmyths.org to discover more shows like this one. The darkness awaits.
Hello and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Sam Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moisoso.
And today we have returned quite triumphantly.
Okay. It's more like we strolled on in and sat back down like usual.
Yeah, I mean, sure. We are back after our unexpected one-week hiatus. Thank you, everyone, for sticking with us there. I hope you all discovered some great new shows to listen to through our little announcement that we put out last week. We're just going to keep that on the feed. So if you ever are like, oh, what shows do Sam and Jason recommend? There they are. It's under the episode titled All Apologies. So anyway.
It's the face-palming angel.
Yes, the face-palming angel.
Quick guide there for you.
In Doctor Who,
oh,
we had the weeping angels back when I watched Doctor Who before it was trash.
You mean, hasn't it always been trash?
No,
I'm sorry.
Really offending probably a fourth of our listener base. I'd like to make one thing clear.
I'm sorry. I watched the first episode that was on Netflix and was like, no, I can't. I can't do this.
I'd like to make something clear here. Because a lot of times nowadays when people say Doctor Who is trash, they're being sexist jerks because they are not happy about there being a female doctor. I don't prescribe to that ideology. I think the doctor can be whomever the doctor wishes to be. However, my bigger problem is that after David Tennant's seasons, everything began to suck, and it has just continued to
suck.
Just
the writing?
So what it is they changed showrunners, right? They went from a man named, I think his name was Russell T. Davies. He was an artiste in his crafting of storylines. And then they gave it to a guy named Stephen Moffat, who is just this heavy-handed fool who I despise.
So would you say he's like Britain's Michael Bay?
I think calling Stephen Moffat the Michael Bay of Doctor Who is actually the most accurate thing we could do.
So there's explosions.
Not necessarily. He did this thing where he wanted every episode to end with you going like, oh my gosh, I can't believe, and he just didn't tell the story.
So
I feel like
he's trying to leave so many cliffhangers and pull like a whole like metagame, Westworld or Game of Thrones style of a episode every week.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Imagine the last.
He has to be really good or HBO to do that.
Yeah. Well, imagine the last episode of a Game of Thrones season every single week. That's what he was like going for, and it just didn't work. But regardless, beyond all that, how'd we even get there? How'd we even start talking about that? I don't recall. Oh, the Weeping Angels. That's right.
Yes.
In Doctor Who, we have the Weeping Angels. In our episode feed, we have the face-palming angel, which signifies that we dropped the ball and didn't release an episode last week, and we're sorry for that.
Yeah, it's the angel that's disappointed in us.
Yes, yes. But we are back. Now, do you remember Jason? No, I'm asking our listeners. Do you remember Jason?
Oh, how could they forget me? You didn't forget me, did you?
Please. Jason, do you remember 2 weeks ago what we were talking about?
Yes.
What was it?
Street art.
Street art. Yes. You're
a
not wrong.
With four lines of code in it.
Toynbee idea. In movie 2001. Resurrect dead on planet Jupiter. The Toynbee tiles.
I love how you went ahead and said everything because I forgot.
Yeah, I got you. I've read this message like 5,000 times.
I know. So have I. I see it in my head, but it's just like... I'm like, no,
get out of here, ghost. Okay, so anyway, 2 weeks ago, we started our series on the Toynbee tiles, which is truly, really a series on the Toynbee tiler, the one doing this. Now, last time we were here, we tried to paint a picture for you of this Toynbee tiler. Now, what we know from that core message and the other addendums that he's added to the tiles through the years, what we know is that the Toynbee tiler is a man who believes that he is being suppressed by the media. He's targeted by gangsters, and he is dying a death too young. He believes that his best hope...
Caused by an illness, of some sort.
When he caught a fatal disease, they gloated over his death. That's what one of the tiles says. Mm-hmm. Now, he believes that his best hope for a life after this has to do with an obscure passage of spiritual writings from one of the 20th century's most prolific historians, as well as this scheme of reanimating dead molecules on the planet Jupiter. He believes in a sci-fi afterlife, a constructed heaven, and the individuals working against him are not only trying to discredit him, but they are driving him to insanity. And they are actively dismantling his last best hope of immortality. That's some heavy stuff.
Yeah.
If that's like your headspace, that's not a great headspace to be in.
And most of the time, he packs all that information in the size of less like a 1x1 foot square.
It's quite impressive. Yeah. Yes. These tiles are about the size of license plates. Some of them are very large. Some of them are even smaller than that, though.
But jog my memory. We did cover the manifesto tile last week, or week before last, correct?
Yes.
Which that one is, I believe, the largest. It's like six tile sizes or something like that. It's, like
it's
really big.
Four tiles it's four. Put together. I think the whole thing ends up being about 4 feet by 4 feet. So it's actually quite large.
Yeah.
It was before it was
And that's
paper.
Where we get the majority of the information about the actual person.
Yes, that's where the tiler sets it out loud and proud that he's being hunted by the media, and gangsters are coming to his house and roughing him up. And
oh, dude, that's just the TMZ guys. Early days, man, were rough for him.
Now, the mystery of the tiles, right? Their meaning, how they're made, that's one part of the enigma of the Toynbee tiles. But the identity of the tiler is something that has been tantalizing the public since the first tiles began popping up back in the early 1980s. Around the same time that these tiles started popping up, though, the first clue as to the identity of the tiler was published inadvertently in the March 13th, 1983 edition of the Philadelphia Inquirer. Now, Jason, you just mentioned...
What?
You just mentioned the manifesto tile, right?
Yep.
Big old thing, and it tells this story of a man who is being hunted, not just by the media in general, but specifically by a individual known as John Knight, who is the head of the Knight Ritter Media conglomerate. By the time that the tile was laid, John Knight
was
had been dead.
Long gone.
Yeah, for quite some time. But what he mentions, what the tile mentions, if you'll remember, is the Inquirer. Okay, it talks about goons from the Inquirer being sent down to bash in his windows with baseball bats. Okay, so...
And I mean, just like any good manifesto, it was riddled with paranoia.
Oh, every good manifesto is.
Yeah, exactly.
The Unabomber... He had a good one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just putting that out there, is that if it's a manifesto, there's paranoia in there. And it definitely shows through. And I think a lot of that has to come with, well, what we're about to probably talk about, assuming, hopefully.
Yes, I think
Which
so.
Which is...
Here we go.
Like that layup, it was horrible.
Just alley-oop.
This is what happens after a week break. Yeah. I am rusty.
We're getting back into it. Now, okay, so this article, right? The Philadelphia Inquirer, theoretically, the same Inquirer that sent goons to terrorize the tiler later on. In this account, it's written by a local columnist by the name of Clark DeLeon, and his column is titled, "Wanna Run That By Me Again?"
I gotta say, I dig that column title.
Oh yeah, "Wanna Run That By Me Again?"
I like it.
He talks about this individual who contacted him by the name of James Marosco, okay? They did this whole thing by phone. It was a phone interview. The first sentence of the 3-paragraph article is, quote, "Call me skeptical, but I have a hard time buying James Marasco's concept that the planet Jupiter would be colonized by bringing all the people of Earth who had ever died back to life and then changing Jupiter's atmosphere to allow them to live.
I think there's like three different things that has to happen for the whole statement to be true.
Okay.
First off, Jupiter has to be a livable planet.
Right.
And then we have to be able to reanimate the dead.
Right.
And then we have to change Jupiter's atmosphere, which the first and second one are pretty well
wild.
Tied.
Yeah.
But Jupiter is so massive that we wouldn't be able to survive under its gravity.
They don't even
so like it's so big. Like, gas giants are called failed stars. Like, if Jupiter was much larger, it would have been a star.
That raises some questions for me. The first one. So there's no, and I'm pretty sure I know this, there's no surface of Jupiter, right?
Technically there is.
There's it's a core?
It's a metallic sea of hydrogen. Mm. The surface and the atmosphere are almost the like exact same. The density of the surface is very, very low. There's a core probably.
I heard that at one point, even though it's not solid, it's just gas, like the gravity combining with the gas, if you were to drop someone through or onto or whatever Jupiter, they wouldn't necessarily hit the surface of Jupiter, but they would stop falling because of how much pressure the gas is under. I don't know if that's true, but I heard it once.
That'd be interesting.
And it's really dope. It's a really dope concept. Yeah,
gas giants in general just kind of boggle my mind.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, I'm on Earth, and there's ground beneath us, and I think that's a planet.
Yeah, yeah.
When I think of gas, I don't necessarily think of a planet. I think of flatulence.
Yes, or stars.
Yeah.
Or gas, yeah. So if I took a lighter to Jupiter, would it explode?
Well, Jupiter is already, it has lightning storms and stuff, man.
Hmm.
Like, it's constantly a storm.
But I thought hydrogen was very flammable.
Okay, so I'm not an astrologist. I don't know anything.
You mean an astronomer?
Both.
Good. Good. Because I don't want you to be an astrologist, that's for sure.
Or an astronomer. They're so similar.
Are they?
Right. They are. They both look outward, you know? To find meaning. So until we get Neil deGrasse Tyson on the show,
we're not
then we'll really talk about stars and planets and what separates
so
them.
Is it fair to say that,
but I assume the amount of, again, gravity that Jupiter produces is a little strong for us to withstand.
Is it fair to say that resurrecting the dead on Jupiter without the let's say that we knew how to resurrect the dead, that doing it on Jupiter is probably not the best idea.
I would much rather do it on Tahiti.
Anyway, here's something cool. Here's something cool about what you said. Not
okay.
The Tahiti thing.
Yeah.
The other thing about it being implausible. Not only does Clark de Leon agree with you, but James Marasco also agrees with you.
All right, we're done here, guys. This is that. We're wrapping up. I'm right for once.
Well, I don't know if I'd say that.
It.
I don't know if I'd say that now. But interestingly enough, De Leon goes on to mention explicitly that while Marasco told him that this theory was based off the film 2001: A Space Odyssey, which was based off the writings of Arnold Toynbee and this and that, interestingly enough, Marasco appears to be skeptical of the idea that he is trying to propagate. He's quoted as saying, quote, "There are no scientific principles I've found that can make this possible, especially colonizing the planet Jupiter, which has a very poisonous atmosphere. The possibility of giving that planet an oxygen atmosphere is beyond even science fiction writers' imaginations." And yet, De Leon was being subjected to this ranting and raving from Marasco because he felt like, while it was beyond him to understand how it could be done, that it could be done one way or the other. If you just had the right person thinking about it and working at it, you could get the dead resurrected on the planet Jupiter.
See, I'm just assuming that it's a space station at Jupiter.
Yeah, that could
not,
be.
Not necessarily on Jupiter, but maybe siphoning some sort of energy source from Jupiter.
Right. Well, and again, at the end of 2001, A Space Odyssey, the main character goes through kind of like a portal sort of, maybe.
Time warp?
Kind of. I don't know.
Sure.
Near Jupiter, right? Okay. It's like orbiting Jupiter. So maybe it's just something like that. However, according to De Leon, there's one other important aspect, especially when we're looking at the search for the Tyler that comes out of this interview. Okay, Marosco tells Clark De Leon that he is a member of something that is called the Minority Association.
Ooh.
Yes.
Do they have a report?
Right? I know. It sounds like something from a Philip K. Dick novel, which I can dig, but this organization is set up pursuant to the goals of resurrection on the planet Jupiter. He claims that the Minority Association is consisted of four individuals. It's him, it's Eric, it's Eric's sister who does the typing, and it's Frank. These four.
Oh, yeah, people. Frank from the block.
You know Frank. I'm still Frank from the block. Now, I love the way that he ends this article. De Leon says, "You may be hearing more from Marosco, and then again, you may not." Now,
man, I want to read his column.
I know, right? It seems delightful. He probably, even to this day, scratches his head and is baffled by just how prolific this has become, how just mainstream.
Or he just doesn't think about it at all.
No, he thinks about it because people call him to this day.
God.
Stop calling people. Like, I understand you want to be detectives. I understand that. But people have lives.
The search for knowledge, man.
They have things they need to do. So we have a few takeaways from this column. We have the Minority Association. But we have, more specifically and more importantly, we have the name James Marosco, okay? This is the original jumping off point, and it can serve well for the introduction, or it can serve as well for an introduction to the man who would eventually become the closest to definitively unmasking the Tyler once and for all. Now, we had mentioned last week, or last episode, that there was a man who came across a freshly laid tile. And before this, we didn't really know how the tiles were made, what they were constructed of, how they were installed, and all of that. And then after that, we had this idea that they're linoleum wrapped in tar paper and glue and asphalt crack filler and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's like a sandwich.
Exactly. A delicious...
No, the delicious opposite of delicious. Sandwich.
Now, the man who came across this Tyler is named Justin Durr. I think it's Durr. It's D-U-E-R.
I want to say it's Durr.
Durr. Okay. And this is the individual who discovered the construction of the tile and is also the subject of an award-winning documentary by the name of Resurrect Dead.
Was it award-winning?
Yeah, it was award-winning at the Sundance, I think, at least, as well as elsewhere. It is... The documentary Resurrect Dead is like the absolute standard. If you're going to do one bit of research, which for this subject, you need to do a lot more. But if you're only going to do one piece.
That's all I did.
You need
Oops.
To. Yeah, yeah. You saw it, didn't you?
Yeah,
you watched it.
Yeah.
It was pretty good.
I actually enjoyed it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really, really good film.
It was a lot longer than I expected as well. Mm-hmm, it's like an actual like full length movie.
Yeah, it's like an hour and a half or something.
I guess if you're into cartoons, it's a full length movie.
If you watch a lot of anime or just cartoons, Adventure Time. Anyway, so according to Deer's own words, okay, he noticed his first Toynbee tile in 1993 or early 1994. Okay. He was working as a package courier, moving on foot, crisscrossing Philadelphia multiple times a day when he noticed his first tile. And he began to pay more and more attention to the tiles.
Yeah, I remember. He always remembered the first.
Yeah. It's a special time.
Yeah.
He paid more and more attention. He saw more and more tiles as he went by or went on. And it just began to pull him in. He found himself very, very interested, and he was asking his friends and his family and all of that. He even recalled in the documentary how the first day that the public library got access to the internet, the very first thing he did, he actually took the day off of work and he went to the library, and the first thing he ever typed into a search engine was the phrase Toynbee idea, and it came back with absolutely nothing. The internet was very young in these days.
I cannot understand that.
Finding no results.
Although I've got close, as I'll mention later on.
All right. I dig it. Yeah, so no results. A few months later, he goes back, searches for it again, and he finds now a result of Toynbee.com, which was run by a local Philadelphian named Bill O'Neill, who, very much like Durr, had simply come across the tiles by walking around the city in the early 90s. Now, O'Neill was cataloging every tile that he could and crowdsourcing others to do the same. It was through this website that people really understood that this was more than just a local Philadelphia phenomenon. You know, it happens primarily there, but it's all over. They found tiles as far west as Kansas City, as far east as Boston, and it was even that I don't think he included it in the official tile list. But there was somebody emailing him saying, hey, I'm down in Santiago, Chile, and there's a tile here as well. But I don't think he believed him. He didn't include it in the list. Now, this same individual, Justin Durr, he, upon finding this freshly laid tile, right, he does something that I just really love. Because he talks about, he's a very interesting man. He's like a grown-up punk, right? He was like a punk kid, and then he grew up. And he's still a punk. Yeah, but like a good punk, not like Lou Punk. And like he's like an artist and he like squats in warehouses and stuff like that. It's awesome. I love this guy. And he's talking about how he has insomnia and he can't sleep and this and that. So it's 4 a.m. and he goes to the grocery store or he goes to the convenience mart and he finds the tile and he understands what's going on. And he just starts running through the streets at 4 a.m. just screaming, I believe in the Toynbee idea, I believe in it. And he's just hoping that the Tyler is going to hear him and make contact, but of course, there was no such luck. But this encounter, this finding of the tile, is really what got him deep into this. It went from a curiosity to an obsession. And one of the first leads that he chased down was indeed this interviewer, Clark De Leon. Now, Justin got a hold of De Leon, who, after 20 years, still remembered the bizarre phone interview that he had had with the man. De Leon, and I know I was saying De Leon earlier, so just live with it. Clark, as we'll say, told Deere that Marasco had the feel and the cadence of a blue-collar, working-class Philadelphia individual from a lower-class neighborhood. That's just something that he divined from his conversation. He claimed that he had written of the tiles before the interview with Marasco, which is what led Marasco to contact him. However, this original column has never been found. There's never any indication that Clark did write about the tiles beyond him saying it. And who knows? Archives aren't that great. But the interesting thing is that off the record, it's not addressed in the interview itself. Off the record, De Leon asks Marasco, he says, have you seen those tiles around town? They sound very similar to what you're doing. Are you laying them down? And Marasco says, no, I'm not laying them down, but I do know who this person is. And Clark believed him. He didn't see any reason why he would lie at this point. And so as Justin Deere is talking to him, he basically says, like, you can try to chase him down, but it's the wrong tree to bark up. You know, this guy is not the Tyler, I can guarantee it. Now, he said that the man that he spoke to was very proud of his education. He was not very confident, and he had a soft bass voice.
Oh.
Yes, very, very calming. That's not.
That was none of the above.
Very calming. No,
still.
Nope.
Just stop. You're done.
Like Donald Glover.
You're done.
No, his voice is deep enough.
Continue.
Like Billy D. Williams.
Just continue.
Watch
just,
out.
Just keep going. Tell me more about these tiles.
Now, a search through the phone book showed only one James Marasco living in Philadelphia at the time. You having the burp?
Ooh.
Yeah, it's a good burp, isn't it?
It's a weird one.
Yeah. The search through the phone book showed only one James Marasco living in Philadelphia at the time. Now, when contacted, this phone number that was called, you got a little bit of a weird response, okay? For one thing, this neighborhood that the individual lived in was a very high-class, upper-class neighborhood. It was not at all the kind of place where the Tyler, as described by Clark De Leon, would live. that James Marosco would live.
It's that new money.
It's that new money. It's that Gatsby money. Exactly. However, when one individual called the number, because GR was not the first to, like I said, chase down Clark de Leon or to call these people or anything like that. When one individual called the number, a woman answered the phone and they said, "Can I talk to James Marosco?" And she said, "No, you can't talk to James Marosco because he can't talk because he was very sick and they had to remove his voice box."
An illness, you say?
An illness. And also an illness
interesting
that makes one non-vocal. That's very interesting, isn't it? It's very, very interesting. 2 years later, another reporter called and was told that Marosco was dead, but that he didn't know anything about the tiles anyway when he was alive. Now, looking through the records, they saw that Marosco had died at the age of 88, and therefore, when the tiles were first being laid, he would have at least been in his late 60s, if not his early 70s. Not to mention that the caller was told that he had been deceased for a few months, during which time new tiles were popping up, not only in Philadelphia, but all over the world.
Okay, so that rules him out.
It pretty well rules him out. It would seem as though the investigation came to a dead end right there. And for a long time...
Unless it was Junior. There you go. I got a laugh out of him.
There you go.
All right.
For a long time, that was the end of the investigation. Like I said, some individual was trying to tell Bill O'Neill that there was a tile in Santiago, Chile with a Philadelphia address on it, but O'Neill wouldn't listen. He just didn't think it was credible.
But that ain't a coincidence.
It's not a coincidence, but it could have been a troll, right? Remember how hard it was? How hard it used to be to send a photo through email?
No. I do. I didn't talk to strangers on the internet, Sam.
What?
That's not something I did.
Anyway, it used to be, for all of our younger listeners, it used to be a real pain to try to send a photo through email.
Oh, man, dude. Dial up? Oof.
Yeah, it was unreal.
See, no, that was my issue, is the fact that where I lived, it took like 3 hours to download a song.
Yeah.
How do you think I'm going to upload a photo?
Yeah, you're not. You're not. However... The investigation led by Jure. So basically what happens is, okay, over time, Bill O'Neill is sick of the Toynbee Tyler. So all of this that's happening...
I think we're all sick of him.
All of this that's happening with Jure is happening in the early 2000s. And about this point, it's been about 10 years since Toynbee.com, and Bill O'Neill is just sick of it. He hands over the keys to Toynbee.com to Justin Deere and his investigative team. And they're going through these emails when they find this information by this individual in Santiago, Chile. And they say, okay, all right, what's going on here? They basically breathe a new life into the investigation itself. Now, crazily enough, as they find with every step of their investigation, even though the Santiago tile had not been treated as very, what am I trying to say?
Credible?
Credible. Yes, that's exactly
legit.
The word. Legit. Even though it wasn't being treated as very legit at the time, people had still investigated it, and he was still not the first one to investigate it, but he does. He goes to this address that's listed on the tile. It's a South Philadelphia address. It is a lower class neighborhood. It does kind of match the description of what Clark de Leon is talking about. And what he finds is nobody to answer the door. He's knocking on the door. They're all knocking on the door and there's nothing. But the neighbors are coming out and they start talking to Deere and his investigation. Now, what they find out is... the absolute perfect suspect for the Toynbee Tyler. It's a man by the name.
All the little pieces are coming together.
Mm-hmm. It's a man by the name. And it should be noted as well, as they're in this neighborhood and going around, they see proto tiles in the sidewalk and in the asphalt.
Oh, yeah.
They
like,
see.
It's like David trying to perfect the xenomorphs. except with tiles.
Yes, exactly. They see little credit card size tiles. They see little new different kinds of ways of doing tiles, all in a radius around this address. Now, as they get there, they learn of a man by the name of Julius Paroli, who is known as Railroad Joe by his friends and neighbors. Okay.
Love it.
Yeah, right. It's a good name. It's a good name. Very, very little is known about Railroad Joe. And almost all of the information that we do have of him comes from interviews with his neighbors. But what they say, or what they say in these interviews is, to say the least, very intriguing. Joe was an employee of Conrail, which is a railroad moving throughout the northeastern United States. It's unknown exactly what Joe did for Conrail, but he was gone a lot. Now, the routes that Conrail follow, that Joe theoretically would be riding the rails on, these routes go as far west as Kansas City and as far east as Boston. And every place that the tiles were discovered was a major stop on these train routes. Okay.
That seems too
convenient.
Yes.
Yes.
Is someone setting him up?
Potentially. It's okay. Possible. And in fact, so the question then is, what about Chile, right?
Yeah. How? There probably is not a railroad down to Chile.
There's probably not a railroad down to Chile, but what there is, and I couldn't find a lot of information on this actual event itself, but in Chile, around this time in the mid to late 80s, there was the world's largest telescope being built down there for an observatory in Santiago, in the mountains. And the lens, this gigantic piece of glass, the transfer of it took very many steps through very many different travel agencies and all of that, one of which was Conrail.
You gotta be
I'm not kidding you. In fact, it would seem that Conrail, and by extension Julius Paroli, is exactly completely, you could overlay a map, right? And they are the same places around the same time. But there's a catch. Julius Paroli has been dead since 1987. Oh my God. What? You definitely didn't see that in the notes. Yes, you did.
I watched again.
You watched the same documentary.
I'm just acting stupid.
It's good. It's good. I like it. Thank you. So Paroli died definitely after the tiles started, but the comparison between the tiles of 1987 and the tiles of the early 2000s and late 1990s, they look to be made by the same person. Mm-hmm. They do not look to be like a copycat or anything like that, just based on handwriting
hand carving.
Yeah. Which is interesting as well, because Paroli, his family, their business was carving tombstones. So it was the perfect match.
I would assume they would have been cleaner. As in, like, better lines and everything.
Oh, maybe. Linoleum's not great to work with,
I would hope not.
It's not meant to be made this way. True. So he dies, right? 1987. And that's a shame, to be sure. However, when Joe dies, he does something curious. He wills his home, that same address that's found on the tile in Santiago, Chile, to somebody else. None of Railroad Joe's neighbors know exactly what the relationship between the dead railroad worker and the current resident of the home is. However, he had been there since Joe died in 1987. His name is Severino Verna, but everyone just calls him Sevi, or even better, the Birdman. Birdman. And again, in Sevi Verna, we have quite the suspect, okay? According to neighbors, Sevi does not leave the house. He is a recluse. It is not known how he makes his living. They say...
Reminds me of someone else I know.
Okay. I go to work. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh.
I go out and I play magic. I go to sometimes people...
Once. You did that once.
Shut up. Sometimes people make food and I go to their houses to eat food. I leave my home.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right.
Sevi's neighbors say that he must do something at night, that he has to do some sort of a night work. That's the only thing they can think of as to how he makes his living.
It's got to be it.
Okay. But it's known that he is a very frightened, private individual who loves one thing in his life very passionately, which are his birds. Sevi has kept pigeons for all of his life, and according to these individuals, as well as others tracked down through the investigation, Sevi would take dead pigeons and attempt to preserve them. He would place them in buckets and cover their bodies with concrete in order to keep them ready to be brought back to life
at
some future.
That's not how taxidermy works.
That's like the opposite of taxidermy.
You gotta sterilize them first, right? Ugh. I mean, but you gotta kill the bacteria from decomposing
He doesn't want that, because he wants to bring them back to life.
Okay, so Sevi.
Sevi.
Apparently a weird guy that likes birds.
He's a weird guy.
Doesn't understand the basic concepts of decomposition.
That's fair. Which is interesting because Sevi's family owned a funeral home. And it traumatized him early and often.
Well, yeah. Have you seen the embalming process?
Yeah. No, yeah. But it's enough.
I've heard descriptions. I don't need to see it. I'm good.
Apparently, his fear of death has been crippling ever since a child. Ever since he was a child.
Thing to be afraid
right?
of.
Right? So we have in Sevi Verna a very, very, very good suspect. Now, interestingly enough, there's like this little side thing in the documentary where Verna is the bird man and he loves his pigeons. And Justin Durr also loves pigeons and like nurses them back to health and things like that.
They're the same.
It's this weird little thing. Also, I'm just going to say this now so that everybody can have this image in their heads. Whenever I think of Sevi Verna, I always think of Tommy Wiseau. I just think that would be the perfect Sevi Verna. So do you know who Tommy Wiseau is?
God, from the Room? I'm having, oh.
Yeah.
I'm like, man, that name. I know who that is.
Yeah.
Who is that? Oh, dear Lord.
I think he would be a great Sevi Verna.
Yeah, if you can learn how to act.
That's like another freaking mystery all in itself, The Room, because like this guy comes out of nowhere. He's dropping millions of dollars on this movie. No one knows where he came from, what his real name is, where he's getting his money. It's insane. It's crazy. And every time someone asks him, he just ignores it. He just moves on to other questions. I don't think we're going to do an episode on The Room, but maybe we will. Who knows?
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
That will be the day.
Oh, no. So, yes, Durr and his team, they're feeling pretty good about Verna at this point. They're knocking on his door trying to get a response, but there's not even a peep that comes out. They enlist the help of neighbors and quote-unquote friends of Sevi's, and he just will not open the door for anyone. Now, the investigators then reached out to Sevi's mother via phone call. Basically, what they did, it seems like from the documentary, is they just opened the phone book, and they called everyone with the last name of Verna, because in the show, they're doing, oh, I'm calling about a relative of yours. I think his name's Severino Verna, and then he's like, oh, you're his mom. Cool. And then they talk about it from there. So Verna's mother, whose name we don't know, they learn from her that they're definitely not the first person to call about her son. Again, it's something where they keep getting beat to the punch each and every single time.
Yeah, what happened to the first investigative team then?
What happened
to them?
They died.
Yeah.
If you look, there's articles, news articles on this, and Sevi's name gets thrown around in the late 90s, the early 2000s. It just doesn't seem that anyone goes much further past, especially like this phone call here, okay? So they're talking with Sevi's mother. They tell her more about the tiles. She knows about him, but they're telling her more about him, and she says that it could not be her son. He could not possibly be connected to the tiles because he has a serious medical condition that would preclude the possibility of him traveling such far distances. She was reluctant to say exactly what it was, but it was something that had to do with his lungs.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
And illness.
Exactly. Another illness. The most interesting thing about this is that you just can't discount the Julius Paroli. The fact that Con Air, or not Con Air, not Con Air.
Yeah.
Con Rail goes the exact east to west and then south of the tiles themselves makes him such a good suspect.
So do you think Railroad Joe was an early accomplice?
It could be.
Because Joe was in his later years of his life that he also subscribed to this idea of being resurrected.
He passed on the craft, the trade. Yeah, it could be. It really could be. This seems to be the point where other investigators pretty much end. They just say, okay, well, it's not Verna, it's not Joe, it's not Marasco. I don't know who it is. He is a good suspect. Now, at this point, or sorry, we already talked about this. So Bill O'Neill, right, he's given over the keys to Toynbee, not Ned or .com, whatever it is. They start combing through. Justin Deere's team combs through the Toynbee.net emails, and they are finding more conspiracy theories than you can shake a stick at.
Who'd have thought?
Right? Aliens, faking of the moon landing, JFK, like we covered last week, all sorts of different crazy things until they find another break in the case. And they are. If you read like interviews with Justin Deere and his crew, they basically, he talks about how it's just like they kept getting so close and then it was a stone wall. Mm-hmm. And then they would not fully, but kind of start slumping and start being like, all right, I'm going to give up now. And then they'd get again so close again. They get a break in the case. And that's what happens combing through these emails. What they find is a few different emails relating to pirate radio and pirate television broadcasts. Now, the first account was from a man by the name of Joe Raimondo. Okay. He claimed that in 1985, he was watching the news on Channel 3 when out of nowhere, the sound associated with the news program tuned out and a strange voice replaced that of the anchors. Raimondo couldn't say exactly what the broadcast said, but he did remember the mentioning of Toynbee, of 2001, and of Arthur C. Clarke. As quickly as the broadcast was there, it was gone. Now, Joe calls the news station, and he's told, he says, hey, there was this weird transmission that came through, and this is what they were talking about. And the person on the other end at the news station just says, yeah, well, you're not the only person that happened to. We've been getting calls like this for the last 10 minutes nonstop off the hook. So that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It comes, it goes. It's a pirate radio station, which I think we should do with this show. I think we should just drive around and pirate radio this. Does anyone even listen to the radio anymore?
I try not to.
I actively try not
especially
to.
Especially, like, recently I've noticed, like, songs have been out for, like, 6 or 7 months. And you're like, oh, this is a future hit. I'm like, dude, that was a hit, like, 3 months ago.
Yeah.
It's on the downslopes now.
It's
no longer a future hit.
Yeah, I hate
future hit back in the day.
And the same thing with TV, right? A lot of people don't watch normal TV. They just watch streaming services and stuff like that. I guess maybe if we like did it the same time as the 10 o'clock
news. Because
the
media is evil.
Yeah, it is. It is evil. But I just think that's a really great idea, is this pirate station that's just hijacking the airwaves. It's something called culture jamming is something I found about it. So
that's
pretty
cool.
Pretty neat. Now, okay. So there's that.
I wonder what kind of setup you need to do that.
We'll talk about it.
Oh, good.
Yeah. We actually get to the bottom of that, too.
An antenna, 12 feet tall.
Pretty much. So that's the first clue of the short wave radio puzzle, the pirate radio. Now, there was another possibly reliable report in an email sent to Toynbee.net by a man by the name of Nathan Mell. Now, according to Bill O'Neill, Mell claimed that he had met a street prophet type of individual who was going around Philadelphia handing out flyers that had the Toynbee message on it.
Those are the best.
Yeah. Now, one of the members of Deer's crew, a man named Steve Weinick, he ended up tracking down Nathan Mell, who corrected the story that Bill O'Neill had been propagating. He never actually came face-to-face with a Tyler. There was no street profit sort of scenario. All that happened is that Mell came across some strange flyers that were wheat-pasted on bus stops. So it's basically you put the flyer up on the wall, and then you... I mean, we've all seen it in like movies and stuff. And then you take a brush and you paste it up there. That's what they were doing. So he comes across these flyers that are wheat pasted up on bus stops and subway stations in the 1980s, which contain the Toynbee idea. Now, the flyers stated as follows, quote, public notice. Arnold Toynbee's conception of the colonization of outer space as depicted in the movie 2001 A Space Odyssey on the ability of science to bring every dead molecule of every human body of history back to life on gigantic planet of Jupiter. We beg the people of this community to accept us as we have been denied acceptance by the media and press. Please write us at P.O. Box 42678 Phila 19101 USA and tune 6.25 megacycles 48 meters shortwave Saturday night's midnight. This final aspect of the message tuning into the 6.25 megacycles is a reference to shortwave radio. Shortwave radio is radio that takes place between the AM and FM bands, functioning as a place wherein unauthorized transmissions can be broadcasted in order to convey messages that aren't regularly broadcasted on the major radio networks. Shortwave seems pretty cool. I think it would be dope. I'd really like to learn more about this. Apparently there's like a shortwave podcast, which they actually, I think we mention later on. I don't know, maybe not. It's a subversive thing. So it's used by anyone as out there as like the Toynbee Tyler. And it's also used by, like, there'll be religious organizations, like, for instance, in places where Christianity is prohibited, like China, they will broadcast shortwave radio over the border with, like, gospel messages and stuff like that. It's not just for crazy people, right? It's a real thing that real people, cool people, I would say, with hobbies, do. Some people who do it are a little crazy.
Yeah, that's... what I'm probably taking from that.
Yeah, and that's okay. Now, for the investigative team, the handbill provided them another avenue with which they could try to discover the Tyler's identity. Okay, so it seems as though the Tyler is broadcasting fairly regularly, at least every week, at the same frequency, at the same time, back in the 1980s. They figured that if the Tyler was sending messages out every week, it's entirely possible that someone might remember these messages and be able to point them towards another clue. With that in mind, they attend the 2006 Shortwave Listening Convention. They posted flyers all over the place and approached individuals for information. These people are primarily old, straight white men. They, like, Deer is like walking up to him. He's like, have you ever heard anyone talking about resurrecting the dead on planet Jupiter? And they're like, boy, I don't know what... One guy's like, are you making this up? What are you doing? Is this a joke? And you know, the majority of what they find there is very normal people. There was one guy who was like, I can use this literal tinfoil hat to transmit my thoughts to you. And so they went to that guy and they were like, hey, have you ever heard of this thing? And he's like, nah, that sounds crazy. Which was good.
Right? Yeah.
And
I feel like that group of people is a very niche group of like, nerdy kids.
Yeah.
When they're growing up, they're like, oh man, look what I can do with a radio.
Yeah. I'm not disparaging it at all.
Yeah.
It seems really dope. It seems really fun.
I that's the only group of people that I imagine it being a part of, though.
That's fair. Now they go and they actually record, like I was saying, for a shortwave radio podcast. It was called like Pirate Town or something like that. I don't know.
Pirate Town.
I don't know that it's still up.
Goody.
But they also, it is also an active live broadcast as well. And it's ran by this guy named Tim Tron. And they're asking for help and information over the airwaves. However, the most important part of this conference comes right after they record this. There's an individual who says, I've heard about this Toynbee idea and what you're talking about.
See something?
I'll tell you a thing. And his name is John T. Arthur. Okay. Now, he tells the documentary crew that he has had contact with the Minority Association. They basically asked, can we use your P.O. box for a mail drop? Which is a strange thing. I don't even know how you go about asking someone that.
How do you even find out who owns the P.O. box?
Yeah, especially a random stranger. Like, man, this
mail people must have been way more trusting back then or something. Like,
yeah, sure. It's fine. Now, this was in the early 1980s, and he never actually ended up receiving any mail in the P.O. box. He never actually received any mail in his P.O. box for the Minority Association, but he distinctly remembers that name, those people, and talking about Jupiter. Now, the most exciting and just chilling point in the entire documentary, which we highly recommend, is when John T. Arthur says, well, I can't remember too much. Could you throw out some names and try to jog my memory? And one of the documentary crew says, Severino, Sevi. And then John T. Arthur sits there and he's like, Verna? And they're like, yes, actually, Severino Verna. And he says, wow, first try. And I'm like, oh my God, wow.
He actually knows something, or he's a great guesser.
He's a great guesser, or it's a conspiracy, right? So that's the other thing. It could be a conspiracy. That's kind of what I want to believe.
He knew it all along.
Yes. He can definitively say, once his memory is jogged that way, that the man who was signing all of the letters to him, because again, just like in every other interaction with the Minority Association, there's no face-to-face contact. It's letters, it's phone calls, it's that sort of thing.
It's all secretive.
Mm-hmm. The one signing the letters was Severino Verna. Now, with this in mind, the crew goes back to Sevi's neighborhood in order to try to find out more information about this man himself. Once there, we learn that Sevi only leaves his house at night. We kind of mentioned that. He goes grocery shopping around 2 or 3 in the morning.
Are we sure he's just not a vampire?
Well, that could be. It honestly, it could.
There's the paranormal that we were searching for.
Boom.
Sevi, the vampire.
The vampire. Now, he goes grocery shopping at 2 or 3 in the morning. He has plywood on the windows. He never bothers others, and others don't bother him anymore, right?
Mm-hmm.
There was a confrontation once, decades ago. Sevi had always been a night owl. He was suffering from insomnia all of his life, it would seem. But the things didn't get really bad on the shut-in side of things until he had an altercation with some neighbors. Now, Sevi would stay up until 3 or 4 in the morning playing an organ as well as his accordion. And one night,
neighbor... Gosh darn it, Sevi.
I know. It's just not very respectful behavior. But at the same time...
You gotta teach you a lesson.
Yeah, I guess. At the same time, I don't think it justifies a response like this. His neighbor breaks into his home and holds a knife to his throat.
Okay, that's a little extreme.
And says, I'm going to kill you. It was around this time that Sevi boards up the windows and he begins to use these multiple locks on his door. And it about fits in with the same time that the manifesto tile pops up. Mm-hmm. Right. And that this really super paranoid version of the Tyler comes out. It is entirely possible that this altercation...
Yeah, who doesn't like organ playing? It's got to be about the tiles.
You could just hear that at 4 a.m. I was thinking Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah, I'll murder you.
Yeah. I'll just be outside your window with an organ. I don't know if that's how that works.
How are you going to... Okay.
It'll be fine.
I think you have a better option with the accordion.
Yes, that's true. My father-in-law has an accordion that I keep meaning to not like steal, but like borrow from
him. Yeah.
I just have
to take out for a test drive.
Yeah, exactly. Let me just try this accordion out.
All the cool accordions look like 1960s cars.
You're not wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
You're really not wrong.
They've got that like flake paint on them and everything where it's all sparkly, and they've got those weird wing fin things on them for some reason.
They do.
That's what they look like to me.
That's true. I would say this is very possible as the event that the Tyler, whether it's Sevi Verna or anybody else, probably Sevi Verna, was referencing in the manifesto tile when he talks about the goons coming down and breaking his windows and things like that.
Right. That's not a big leap to take.
It's really absolutely not. It's really not. But the biggest bombshell, though, was that Sevi's car has no floorboards. apparently his car on the passenger side has just a hole in it. There's no seat. There's no floorboard.
That's so that his passengers can give him an extra boost.
Exactly. You
the old Flintstone way. Exactly.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Hey, man, he's trying to save the world.
The other interesting thing, although it wasn't there at this point, is that there used to be a very, very, very large antenna on Seve's car. In hindsight here, it is almost too obvious. In fact, they talk about, there's one guy named Franny. He's adorable. I love him. Do you remember him?
I do.
Yeah, he was awesome.
He's a great dude.
Franny is like talking about like, yeah, my dad would like, Seve would be driving around the neighborhood and then there'd be this weird thing that came on our TV and then my dad would run out of the house and be like, damn you, Severino. It's like, why didn't you tell us this earlier? What the heck?
It didn't seem important
before. Didn't think this was important information.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of things from your childhood that you just like pass off as being completely normal because you're a kid.
Until you realize
you're like, wait, it's not. Did this not happen to everyone?
Exactly.
Just our family. Okay. Our neighborhood.
So we know that Severino Verna is a paranoid man. He is very afraid of death. He has been trying to resurrect pigeons for a very long time.
He's been trying to preserve pigeons for a very long time.
For resurrection for a very long time. He has a car with no floorboards.
You know, it is surprising that he just didn't go the whole Frankenstein route.
You know,
just zap him a little bit.
You know, you're not wrong.
He probably cooked one too many pigeons and realized that wasn't the way to do it.
He is, by all accounts, the best option for the frickin' Toynbee Tyler, especially if nothing else, just because of John T. Arthur being like, Verna? However, as they go, and Durr wants to make it clear, and I think it's for good reason, he has nothing but respect for this man. He views him as a great street artist. Like I said, Durr is a punk. He's a punk artist. He loves this whole subversive, like...
Anarchy.
They love it. Those people love anarchy. They love it. And he really respects this Tyler, and he's trying to convey that to him. He gets Franny to go with him. They're knocking on the door. They're trying to get him to answer. And at that point, he just realizes that... And they see him moving behind the curtains. Up on the higher story, they see Severino moving. And Jer just realizes... This isn't good.
Yeah, it's unfortunate we couldn't get him on an episode of Cribs.
This is my crib. It's full of dead pigeons.
This is where I make my tiles. There's my sheets of linoleum.
This is my misplaced hope. I get them at
warehouse pricing.
Nice.
You had no idea how many X-Acto knives I go through over here.
Beautiful. He says this is not good. This is not right. Verna is trying to get his message out, but he does not want the attention. He wants the message out.
Almost on the level of harassing him.
Exactly. Yeah, he seems to be under real, if not physical, at least emotional and mental distress from this. And not to mention, you know, it's a lot of good evidence, but there's no smoking gun. There's no smoking gun of Verna laying a tile or of his name actually on anything at this point. It's just people saying it. So not only might he be harassing a man that he admires greatly, he could be harassing a man who is just set up for this one way or the other. Okay.
You know what you do, right?
Huh?
You just stick a GoPro like right beneath the car, right where that hole is, so that whenever he lays down a tile, the camera is just going to pick up his hand laying down a tile through the floorboard.
On their website, there's a frequently asked questions thing.
Yeah.
And it was like, why don't you
just the stake question, out. Yeah.
Why don't you just stake out? And he's like, because that's creepy.
Well, I mean, you're not wrong.
Yeah, I don't think that's fair. So there's evidence. It's not ironclad, though. And he just feels bad about this at this point. So they say, okay.
I don't know if they stake out. There might be another manifesto tile.
It could be. That's true. People watching him even now.
Part two.
Now, a few weeks, though, after this break in the case, and they say, okay, well, that might be it. That might be all we have. The crew gets a message from an individual named Ulysses Fleming, who, like I said, he had heard the message that they recorded at the shortwave festival or shortwave convention, heard it on a podcast. Woo, podcasts. They're great. Now, he recalled listening to the shortwave stations while driving across the country when he was younger and picking up the Toynbee shortwave station, which included a P.O. box address that could be written to in order to obtain more information on the Toynbee idea. Ulis wrote to it and received the press packet for the Minority Association, which he scanned and sent over to the crew.
Now, he still had it.
He still had it.
Wow.
I love these people.
Wow.
I am that person. Orders. I have so many things from like 20 years ago when I was 4 years old, and I don't need it anymore, but I just don't want to get rid of it because it's cool. So thank you, hoarders. You're the ones who are going to solve these mysteries for us. Every single document sent by Ulis to the team was signed James Marosco. James Marosco. James Marosco. Jim Marosco. This name was associated as the publicity director for the Minority Association. Dozens and dozens of times this name came up to the point where the crew was almost faltering in their belief of Seve as the Tyler. However, there was no James Marosco that fit it. Even if it was this older man, he was dead and he couldn't talk. So, and he before he died, he couldn't talk as well. So that was a big problem. However, on one last page where it would have said James Marosco, publicity director, it was signed and said Severino Verna, publicity director of the Minority Association. The handwriting.
So did he just screw up?
It's possible. It's I don't know. I don't know why he would use an alias for years.
And then,
you know,
put it as a self.
Sometimes you just got to tell people your name. You just got to get it out there.
Why can't we just be humble?
Right? Says the two guys who think that they're interesting enough for people to listen to them every week.
Oh, I clearly
am. Well, obviously. About. So this final page is signed Severino Verna. The handwriting between Verna and Marosco seems to be identical. They both match as well as they can to the tiles, and they also match as well to the same P.O. box that John T. Arthur was supposedly renting out to them as well. It was in this press packet that the Toynbee ideas is officially set out as the reanimation of dead molecules. This physical resurrection, wherein the Toynbee idea is simply the rearrangement of dead molecules into the same physical shapes that they were when they were living molecules. They found a direct quote as well, wherein the Minority Association states it's imperative for, quote, science to perform God's work through scientific means and the manufacture of a real afterlife for all human beings of history. Like I said, we mentioned this before, a constructed heaven, a manufactured paradise, the promise of God's afterlife, or the promise of God for the afterlife, is actually just a prophecy saying that one day science will be able to make this a reality. Again, you see this the reality of Verna's paranoia in that he believes that the press is actively trying to suppress this. Not only his idea, but Toynbee's idea. Toynbee's mandate and God's mandate to create this afterlife. There has been no heaven before, and Seve wants to be one of the first people to go to heaven, as do the rest of the Minority Association. So there it is. The Tyler is most likely Severino Verna. I am reluctant to say it beyond a shadow of a doubt, just because I don't want to believe it beyond a shadow of a doubt. I like there to be a little mystery. They have written multiple letters to Verna. They sent him a finished copy of the documentary. They have never heard back from him. However, there is one final mystery in this enigma, and that's the play by David Mamet. That play 4 a.m. that we mentioned last week.
You thought I'd forget about it,
right?
I was hoping you would.
Right? This play, the most interesting thing about it is that it matches not only concept for concept, but word for word, and it says these dead molecules. All human life is made of molecules. The dead molecules can be made into living molecules. And Mamet still claims that he had absolutely no outside influence on the play itself. But what he does say is that the play is a tribute to Larry King, who before he was on TV, was on the radio. And he would listen to Larry King late into the nights, and he would hear things like this. Around the same time that most likely Severino Verna, acting as James Marosco, was calling Clark Daly on, was papering the town with his Wheat Paste flyers, was driving around in his car, broadcasting his Toynbee idea. Around the same time, multiple individuals reference a broadcast wherein somebody called Larry King and was talking about dead molecules on the planet Jupiter. The documentary crew is kind enough to say Mamet is probably just misremembering and that he was directly influenced by this, but he couldn't, he just doesn't remember it all the way. I don't even know about that. I think he might be just lying, but that's okay. I don't want to defame anyone. Mm-hmm. This is not a defamation case. Thank you very much.
Not yet.
It's not. Yeah. But at the end of the day, we know about, unfortunately, about as much about the Tyler as when we first began. We know he's paranoid. We know he potentially has a sickness. He's afraid of death, and he wants a sci-fi afterlife. Verna...
Don't we all?
Right?
Don't we all?
Verna...
make me a cyborg. I just want to be a cyborg, man.
All right.
Verna, Ghost in the Shell me. Just do it.
Ooh.
I don't care.
Verna refuses to speak with the documentary crew, even to the point where one time, Justin Durr, without actually knowing what Severino Verna looks like, so let's just keep that in mind, he's on a bus, and he sees somebody looking at him from up on the front of the bus, kind of checking him out, and then he's like checking that guy out. And then they get off together at the same stop that's closest to Verna's home, Severino Verna's home. And they just kind of stand there looking at each other for a minute. And at this moment, Justin Durr is almost
certain
that it's Verna. And yet he will not talk to him. He won't say hello because he can tell this individual just looks distressed. And that's where I said last episode, maybe unmasking the Tyler is not the best idea. Now, we've still done it because they did it anyway. You'd find out.
Yeah.
It's all over the place. But it's just an interesting question of, like, is it necessary? And I don't know. Because, again, we don't know anymore. We know a name, but that's it. We don't know.
Yeah, we really don't know who this guy is. Yeah. It's not like he has a Facebook account.
Right. I looked.
Did you?
Yeah, he doesn't have a Facebook account.
I just guessed.
No, he doesn't. It's just
what about MySpace.
probably. It's an interesting idea. So I, regardless of that, regardless of the fact that we are no better than when we started, I enjoy it. I enjoy the Toynbee Tylers or Tile. I enjoy the Toynbee Tyler, who again I just want to assume is Tommy Wiseau. And it's a great modern mystery. And if you know of any other mysteries like this, please point me in that direction because I adore it. But before we close up this episode, Jason did a little bit more research because the Tiles don't begin and end with Severino Verna. They may begin with him, but even then, I'm not sure that they do.
I would like to say that they have a legacy.
They have a legacy. So tell me about that legacy.
So just like, so that experience that Durr had with typing in Toynbee idea and not getting anything, the House of Hades is, the next quote-unquote group that has used the same methodology in very similar styling in order to create street art to convey their own messages. And they're mostly attacks against the media and saying that these tiles are made out of the bones of journalists, which is very, very fun, you know?
Very hardcore.
That's the kind of crafting I like. But there's not much else known about them either. They're also very widespread. We actually even had one back in 2011 downtown.
Really?
It was the House of Hades tile. Yeah.
What?
Downtown Boise. We had at least one. I think it's gone now. They don't seem to be as permanent as the Toynbees, yes.
Even the Toynbee tiles, though, are destroyed on a regular basis. They're not.
Yeah,
they're
yeah.
just vandalism.
Exactly.
To the public or right. to the officials.
To the city. Goes to show the media wanting to strike them back down.
Yeah.
But
he was right all along.
They do The House of Hades tiles, actually, I like a lot more, mm-hmm. mainly because they do have a better aspect of design and artwork to them. They're yeah. actually very well done. Instead of having just their message written across, they do have, some of them have, like, death on them as well, or they're talking, they have different types of icons on them. I highly recommend looking at them. They're very, very cool. They're a lot more thought-provoking in my mind because of some of these illustrations. I believe there's some like spread out legs on a few of them. Yes. That was the one that we had downtown.
Oh, was it?
Yes. And they also did a really good job as far as attracting attention to them. They use a great amount of color, and then they also emphasize certain words against their media hating overlords.
Nice.
One man fighting the media.
Yeah. And I've seen pictures of them from as late, I guess, as last year. I'm sure there have been even more since then.
There's one found in Tokyo as well. Yeah.
That's good.
And like one of the busiest like sections of Tokyo as well, which I don't know how you get away with doing that.
Yeah, you know, you could go full Verna and you could get a car with no floorboards, but I just think that that's a bit much. So I don't know, man. I'm not going to do it. But I really have thought a lot about making these tiles.
There are some very, very cool ones.
They are really neat. And just for science, just for science and research, we're going to link to a step-by-step guide of how to make your own tiles. That I found, and it's really neat. Jason's shaking his head.
Why are you just letting this be out there?
I just want people to know what they're seeing and what they're up against, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, and a lot of the House of Hades tiles do reference the originals, which is something that I like. You can definitely tell that it's a someone that was inspired by the originals, not just trying to copy their work.
Yeah, there's a lot of copycats as well.
Yeah, and weirdly enough, Durr does claim that he met and interviewed with the House of Hades individual, at least one of them. They all both House of Hades does claim to be one person as well.
Yeah,
while having his band at a concert in Buffalo, New York.
Nice.
After that, he asked just because a lot of tiles from House Hades is in that area. He asked if there was anyone from the House of Hades attending, and someone in a white ski mask raised their hand, which that's terrifying.
Yes. Oh, my Lord.
Yes. Apparently, Durr then had a lengthy discussion with him after the concert, which, of course, he cannot divulge any real information about.
No, he, again, on the website, it says, you know, who do you think, another of the FAQs was, who do you think that is behind the House of Hades? Tiles, he says, I know who it is, but we're not going to reveal it for the same exact thing. He doesn't know if he wants to be found, you know, or if he just wants the message.
Well, I feel like the House of Hades tiles, they're kind of the next iteration, the next jump of this style of vandalism, artwork.
It's hard to
call it.
I feel like the tiles are...
The rise against the media.
Yeah.
Anarchy.
Yeah. I feel like the tiles, the House of Hades tiles... are more artistically minded.
Oh, yeah.
Like you mentioned.
Yeah, they're done by someone that has at least somewhat of a background in it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, whereas it's not about the desperate communication of a message like it was for the Toynbee Tyler. But yeah, man, it lives. It lives to this day. And not through any help of my own, it will continue to live. And remember, it is still technically vandalism. So pursue at your own risk. But again, I just...
Tile responsibly.
But again, I just love
this. Away from your home.
Yeah.
On vacation.
Give it a nice radius. I just love this mystery, all in all. It's so bizarre. It's so insane. And it comes down to be, at the end of the day...
It's such an interesting way to communicate an idea to people.
Mm-hmm. I wish I knew how he got... the idea for this, like how he even realized that this was going to work if he tried
work.
Right.
In massive quotations there.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, yes, it sparked interest in it, but it hasn't made any progress wanted to achieve.
The style of art itself. The tiles
and how they
would actually embed and all of that and how he came up with it. Because as far as I can tell, there's no other tiles predating.
Joe probably taught him.
Yeah, probably. But then where'd Joe find it, you know?
Well, he worked at a railroad, so I'm assuming he probably did construction, maybe at
blue collar. Yeah, yeah.
Makes sense to have some sort of idea of road work.
I really believe that it started with Joe. I think that Joe started it, and then Verna picked it up.
I think they're a two-man team.
Yeah. Because they do talk about a movement, you know. It says, it says you must, you know, the Russian media, the U.S. media, against this this movement. But then later on, that's when he says, I am just one man. Mm-hmm. So potentially that means that it was him and Paroli, and then it goes back down to just Sevi. It's good, though, man. It's a good story. Severino Verna, if you're listening to this, I don't even know if you're still alive. I'm pretty sure you are. There was a Severino Verna who died in 2009, and on the Facebook page for the documentary, somebody posted it and is like, is this Sevi Verna? And they're like, no, it's a different Severino Verna, which is a very strange and unique name for Philadelphia, I would assume, but that's fine. So Severino Verna, if you're listening to this, hello. And if you ever want to be on a podcast, you just let me know.
He won't let you know, Sam.
I know.
Keep on tiling.
Keep on tiling, my man.
Lay down them pieces.
Yeah.
They're beautiful.
Yeah.
We ain't coming for you. Don't worry.
Nah, no one's coming.
We ain't leaving our homes.
Nah, we're just like you, buddy.
Oh, yeah.
So,
oh, yeah. Dead of night, that's when I go shopping.
That's our stuff. Anyway, so there you go. That's the Toynbee tiles. I hope you're satisfied, everyone. I hope that was enough for you. Maybe for some people it was too much. Maybe we should have just done one episode.
I hope it wasn't enough.
I hope you're still intrigued, yes. And do your own research. And maybe there's something we missed. And if there is, let us know. If there's a theory, especially a favorite theory when it comes to these, that you've heard that we didn't cover, feel free to send that our way. We always love that. We'll do a little update about it. But beyond that, it was a good one, and I really do hope that everyone enjoyed it. Yeah, Jason, what are we doing next week?
Next week, you and I, and we'll get three other people, we'll all hold hands, ooh, and we'll contact the spirits.
We're not going to do that.
I'll bring a Ouija board and everything.
No, you won't. No, you won't.
Yes, we will.
So translate that into what's actually going to happen.
I am going to take a deep dive on where the Ouija board came from and seances and why they became so popular and a mainstay in pop culture and movies.
Nice. That's actually the first time that Jason has like been like, hey, what are we talking about? Do you know? He said, do you know what we're talking about next week? Or do you have an idea of what we're talking about next week? I said, no. And then for some reason, I was like, why do you? And he was like, yeah, I have an idea. And I was like, oh, nice. Cool. Because usually I just am like, Jason, do a special. I need time to research this other thing. So that was nice. I'm excited to hear it. It should be good. I will rebuke that, or I'll do a rebuttal episode. Not, I don't think one right after the other, because last time with vampires,
rebuttal's a bit harsh.
Well, I mean, it's going to rebuke something. But yeah, last time we did it with the vampires and one just right after the other, it just, I don't know, people were sick of vampires, and rightfully so.
I get it.
We'll talk about that.
Still kind of sick of them.
So that's going to be next week. And then after that, I have, especially if everything works out, I have a good idea of our next multi-part series, which should start right after that Jason special.
Oh, goody.
So we'll talk about that later. No, no, actually, not at all.
Thank
well,
goodness.
Kind of a little bit.
Oh,
everything,
dear.
Everything is. But
dinosaurs?
No.
Oh.
But beyond hope. That, beyond that, here we are at the end of all things.
No, yes. This is not the end of all things,
I
Sam.
I see the sky falling, and I see it crumble.
It should stay up there.
Yeah. Anyway, so really quick.
The simulation going bad.
Really quick, before we leave, we want to thank some people. We want to thank some wonderful people who left some wonderful reviews. So we want to thank Mr. Fart to Shell. I don't know. We want to thank Supernatural Fan 33. We want to thank Thomas Jefferson. That's right. Tommy Jeffy.
Wow.
We want to thank Go Big Orange One. And we want to thank Yerbo Aline. I dig it. We're going to do, where is it? We are going to do Supernatural Fan 33s. So Oh, wait, no. Did we already read it? Oh, we already read one of theirs. Sorry. They, like, updated theirs. I'm sorry. We just can't do that. That just doesn't seem fair. So we're going to do Mr. Fartchel. I don't know exactly how to pronounce that, but they say, why can't I stop? And that's followed up by saying, I had never listened to a podcast. Wow.
Is this the first time you've read this, Sam?
Okay. I scanned it, but I had never listened to a podcast, and my son and his mom got hooked and told me about Not Alone. And after 2 8-hour drives of nothing but Not Alone, I've been hooked. Oh, that makes me want to die. Like 18, oh, no. Sam, 16 straight
up,
hours.
We
that's
have to
crazy.
Ramp up the content.
Yeah. They say, I love it all. But Sam, you can make even aliens feel uncomfortable with those impressions. That's fair. That's fine. That's all right. Keep on, keep it on, guys. I haven't found any podcast that I get as excited of new episodes about. So thank you so much. That's a lovely review, a wonderful review. And we do appreciate that. The other thing that we want to do is thank, I think we got a new patron. Maybe we didn't. It's been a slow few months weeks for patrons, but I think we have. Yes. We want to thank Michael McNally. Woo! Damn it, Jason, wake up.
I'm sorry. My aunt texted me and she rarely texts me. So I was like, wait, what?
That's
what's
fair.
Going on?
That's fair. We would like to thank Michael McNally. Woo! Michael. So thank you so much, Michael. Thank you for everyone who is a patron who pledges every month. That really, truly gets keeps the show going, keeps our research information incoming. Keeps the mics on, as it were. So thank you so much. And then we have a little, it was a request from one of our listeners. I don't know.
Ooh, an assignment.
Yeah, pretty much. I don't know if all of y'all know about this Hawaiian volcano. Have you heard about this?
The one that keeps volcanoing?
Just keeps volcanoing, and we cannot get it to stop.
Volcano's going to volcano.
That volcano's going to volcate?
Volcano's going to volcano.
We laugh, but it is actually a terrible
it's devastating
problem. Yeah, there are lives at stake, neighborhoods, homes, entire childhoods and past and memories
I just don't have any idea of how you could possibly stop a volcano.
Yeah, well, and that's, you know, what our listener said is that when you have something like a storm, right, mm-hmm. the storm goes away. When you have a high water level or something, the high water level goes down.
Right, right.
Lava stays. Mm-hmm. Lava just is there. It becomes
a part
of the island. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, sorry, let me do this here. They say that the cost to rebuild is astronomical. The homes and buildings lost won't be rebuilt. Beyond that, you have the ash cloud, and it's raining down these acid rains due to the sulfur and all of that. It is a nightmare out there. And so what we want to do is go ahead and recommend, we're going to put a link or a few links in our show notes today, to several different pages, GoFundMe pages, or a page called You Caring, that are just funds to help the people. I mean, it's just not something I can imagine. I can't imagine my home not only burning down, but also just the land itself being paved over by nature. So there's a You Caring aid fund going on. There are several GoFundMe pages. There is a local t-shirt company called Crazy Shirts that is selling a special t-shirt, and all of the proceeds go to the aid effort. So guys, just go look at those links in the show notes. If you're able to help donate, that would be fantastic. And, you know, just remember that there are other people in need. So, and you guys are the best listeners ever. You know that. You're very, very good, kind people. So go take a look at those if you're able to. Beyond that, tell your friends about the show. That's a great way of helping us out. And just, you know, keep on being nice to us. We got some reviews. I don't know if you saw them, Jason. We got some reviews talking about how we don't take things like talking stoves seriously enough.
What?
We don't take the aliens seriously enough.
Never. But why would I take the talking stove seriously?
One thing we do take seriously is you, our listeners. And we are just so grateful for everyone who tunes in week to week to week. So thank you all so much. we're going to go ahead and wrap it up here and now. We'll be back next week with a Jason special. And then after that, another series. Something. So who did it last week? I think it was me. And was in fact, I'm pretty dang sure it was
you. You're pretty dang sure it was you?
Yeah. So
last week it was you. The week before that, that's the question though.
Well, we don't need to know because that means it's you this week. So go ahead.
Remember, whether you're searching for a man of mystery or coming across a chance encounter, you are
not alone.